Welcome to Hearing Matters with Dr. Janice Gash, Founding Director of Arizona Hearing Specialist. This is a live call-in show, and your calls are welcome at 790-2040. Now, here's your host, Dr. Janice Gash.
Hello, thank you for joining me today for Hearing Matters. I'm Dr. Janice Gash, your host, and I'm also the founding director of Arizona Hearing Specialists, the first private audiology practice in Tucson. We are celebrating 30 years of helping our patients hear their best and helping patients live their best. As you heard, this is a live call-in show, so please call us with your questions or comments at 790-2040. And if you're calling from the Douglas or Globe areas, you can call us toll-free at 866-725-5467. I am very excited today to have as my guest Dr. Ted Glatke. Ted, thanks so much for being here with me today.
It's a pleasure.
And I thought what we would do is start out maybe having you tell us a little bit about your background, Ted, what led you to audiology, and your very long and varied career. You've retired a couple of times, and you're just can't seem to stay retired. So we'll talk about that, too, at some point.
All right. Well, I first got to Tucson in 1959 as an undergraduate at the University of Arizona, and my interests at that time were in radio, TV, and broadcasting, and not as a talent, but as a production and as a business, basically. At that time, all of the communication arts and sciences were lumped together in one program.
Right.
And so we had Reader's Theater, radio, TV, speech pathology, and introduction to audiology, and all of those folks were all in the same building, the old speech building on campus, and I think we were all on the third floor of the speech building. So everyone took everything. I took a Reader's Theater course and took a public speaking course or two, and individuals who were in public speaking took a survey course in speech correction. So everyone knew a little bit about all those fields. And along the way, an engineer named John Stewart was working on a program funded by the United States Air Force, and his job was to build an analog model of the human ear. And the idea was to have a model of the ear working in response to speech, and if we could understand how the ear worked in response to speech, perhaps the Air Force could improve its the communication abilities among crew members and pilot to ground and things like that. And
so interesting.
We soldered a 36-section ear together. It was in a rack of equipment that was about 6 feet tall and had an oscilloscope screen that wiggled when you talked to it, and it looked like the inner ear, what we thought about the inner ear and how it was working at the time. So that helped me redefine where I wanted to go, and indeed it was the openness of John Stewart and other faculty members all the way along that enabled me to pursue all the interesting things I've been able to do.
Wow, very, very interesting. So you went from the U of A to Michigan for your master's, then to Iowa.
Yes.
And then to Stanford for your postdoctoral work. And then you came back here to Arizona. It must have been 1975 because I had just graduated with my master's degree.
Exactly.
When you had come back to Tucson. And you have been a professor at the University of Arizona from 1975 till 2007.
Exactly.
One of your first retirements.
So retired from the U of A in 2007 and had a wonderful experience both at Stanford for a few years on the faculty there and also at the U of A. And the changes that have taken place in the field and our ability to help people in this 50-year window are just absolutely amazing. And,
yeah, let's talk about that because you've excelled in so many different areas, and perhaps we can talk a little bit about the areas that have been the most rewarding to you, and then some of the most significant developments in hearing healthcare that you have observed and participated in, and probably implemented in audiology over the last 50 years.
Well, hands down, I think the most rewarding is really the academic side and the ability to mentor students. And so there have been about 200 graduate students along the way, most of whom are working in the area in clinical fields or related clinical fields. And a few are in academia, and some of whom have risen to the top of the profession academic-wise. And it's been exciting and challenging to be able to interact with them, to learn from them. In many cases, students made contact with me saying that they wanted to come to Arizona to study, and then they would name an area that I really had very little knowledge about, and so I had to come up to speed in order to help the student get to wherever she or he wanted to get to, and that that really was inspirational and gave me a lot of energy through all those years.
Well, they say we learn more by teaching.
By teaching, exactly.
Absolutely.
But part of this was being lucky to be in the right spot at the right time, and so I got to Stanford just after the first human heart transplant had been done in the United States by Norman Shumway. And the person I work with had just done the first direct nerve stimulation to bypass a broken cochlea. This became cochlear implants. But we were all working in the same lab space. One day there'd be a cow with an extra heart in the lab. The next day there would be, say, a cat that we had wired up for electrical stimulation of the auditory system. And there was only one computer in the whole place. None of us could afford our own, and so we had to share facilities. And we also shared the intellectual stimulation related to things that we were doing. And it was a very, very exciting time. I couldn't have been luckier in terms of the places that allowed me to come in and start to learn from them. At Stanford, we had not only this first direct nerve stimulation project, and we were the first group to receive funding from NIH to study cochlear implants, but there was also the first attempt at universal screening for all the babies born at the Stanford Hospital during that same time period.
Oh, very interesting.
Excuse me. And the techniques then were fairly crude. We had what was called a cribogram. We wired every crib. Well, not we. I was just on the fringe of it. But the group that working on that wired every crib in the nursery with a motion detector. And then we blasted sound through the loudspeakers in the ceiling several times a day. And we thought if a child could hear and were asleep, he would wake up and we would see the motion. If he were awake and crying, he'd be interested in the sound he heard, so he'd quiet down and we'd see the lack of motion or the change in motion.
And how long of a period of time did you monitor these kids? Because they probably weren't in the hospital for very long.
Well, back then they were. It was a 3-day stay. It was a pretty typical stay for well babies. Cool. And so we maybe tested them on the order of 40 times over a 3-day period. And all of this stuff was recorded on what looks like an old strip chart recorder, or your listeners might think of an EEG recorder where you see the squiggles of the pens writing out.
Right.
And so people went around every day and had to relate these squiggles on the pens to who occupied the crib and all of that. And I think over the life of this, there were some thousands of babies screened, and it turned out to be a not as sensitive as we would like or as precise as we would like, but it was the first attempt to do this on a wholesale basis and anticipated what we were able to finally accomplish in the 1990s, some nearly 30 years later.
Very interesting. And just an interesting note for you. When I, in the 70s, when I worked out at Keno Hospital, they had instituted a program with the telephone pioneers coming in to do some newborn screening. And so it's pretty amazing where we are today, because now the universal newborn screening is essentially happening all over the country. I'm not sure if it's happening all over the world.
It's not definitely not happening all over the world, unfortunately. But I might say that Arizona was in the forefront of adopting universal screening. The first program in the state was at Scottsdale Memorial Hospital in the early 1990s. The second one was at Phoenix Indian Medical Center. And then the third one started at St. Joseph's here in Tucson. And I think if I suggested that we are screening about 98% of all the babies born in the state, I think that that's pretty accurate today. And the important part of that is that Screening allows us to identify hearing loss early enough to intervene in a way that's very meaningful. So when you and I started our careers clinically, the average age of identification or confirmation of a hearing loss in a child was somewhere between 3 and 5. And it was usually driven—
if the child was lucky to have that done at 3 to 5.
And was usually driven by a concerned parent. And the problem, as we now know, is that if you wait that long to introduce language, a child may have insurmountable obstacles to acquiring language at a useful level. The beauty of identifying them at birth or in confirming a hearing loss soon after birth is that we can provide whatever options the parents wish in terms of language acquisition, be it oral or auditory language or sign language. It doesn't really make much difference. We can get the child ready for school at age 6 if we can intervene early enough. And that's been, I think, the important blessing associated with that particular effort. So it was fun to be on the fringe of it. And then a bit later, as I mentioned earlier, students occasionally would check in and say, I'd like to come study with you. And then they would mention an area that they wanted to pursue. And I'd say, gee, I don't know anything about that, so we're going to have to learn about this together. And that particular area in the 80s was what's been called otoacoustic emissions.
Great. Let's take a few-minute break to hear from our sponsors, and then let's come back and talk about otoacoustic emissions.
Southern Arizona's most powerful weekend talk, only on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice.
Did you know that avoiding loud noises may help prevent premature hearing loss? This is Dr. Janice Gash, founding director of Arizona Hearing Specialists. There are easy ways to identify if a particular sound is potentially harmful. Do you have difficulty talking or hearing others talk over the sound? Does the sound make your ears hurt? Do your ears ring after hearing the sound? Do other sounds seem muffled after exposure? If you answered yes to any of the above questions, the noise may be damaging your hearing. Most people don't realize how loud many everyday sounds are. Call Arizona Hearing Specialists at 742-2845 to see if you have hearing loss associated with loud noise exposure. That's Arizona Hearing Specialists, 742-2845.
Isn't it a great feeling to get more than you expected when you get more for your money? Well, if you need a new mattress and you love that I can't believe it feeling, you need to go to Sleep America.
We're having our king for a queen sale. It's simple. Buy a king-size mattress, but only pay for the queen-size price. Or if you don't have room for a king, buy a queen-size and only pay for the full-size price.
But don't miss this chance. Sleep America's King for a Queen sale won't last much longer. Remember, mattresses start at just $99 every day.
I'm not comfortable with this. I think Jason should go to college now. I don't want him putting this off. He's already talked to a recruiter. Could you just talk some sense into it?
I understand, but I think if you just listen to him, you'll see. His decision makes a whole lot of sense. He wants to go to college right now, but he also wants to serve. That's why he's been talking to a National Guard recruiter.
The National Guard gives young men and women the unique opportunity to serve their country and communities part-time while they attend college.
You know, we've also got to figure out how we're going to pay for all this. The way things are these days, tuition, room and board, they're through the roof. And with our finances...
Don't worry. He's worked that out with the Guard recruiter, too.
Plus, with the National Guard scholarship and other financial benefits, college students can graduate debt-free. Get to know what serving in the National Guard can do for your son or daughter. Visit NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Are the people who work on your computers inexperienced and unprofessional? Are they just plain flaky? Hi, this is Glenn Ewing of EC Group DeMont. Our team of professionals will work as a part of your team to manage your computer systems and network. Why put yourself and your company through the frustration of flaky service when you can have EC Group manage your network professionally? You can count on us to show up when we say we will, and we'll get the job completed on time and cost effectively. EC Group, we make technology work for you. Call 622-1173.
Welcome back to Hearing Matters. This is Dr. Janice Gash, your host, and today we are talking with Dr. Ted Glatke. And Ted, we started talking a little bit about universal newborn hearing screening and how it's changed over the years. So let's go back from the cribogram and kind of talk about the next level of technology.
Yes. Okay. The next level of technology was really being developed about the same time as we were working on the cribogram, or the folks at Stanford were working on the cribogram, and that was recording the brain's electric responses to sound. And we put small disc electrodes on the surface of the scalp or on the forehead of a newborn and behind their ears, and we could detect very small electrical changes in brain activity associated with a repeated presentation of click-like sounds to the ear. And this method was also fraught with some difficulties. In part, if we didn't control the sleep level of the infant at the time of testing, we would get a certain result that could not be duplicated at some later time if their level of sleep is different. So it was a challenging area to try to develop standards for. But then at the same time, in the same era, someone in San Francisco discovered that the lower centers of the brain also responded synchronously to incoming sounds. And we were able to detect these smaller responses, electrically much, much smaller responses, with more and more robust sampling techniques. And around 1967 or 68, we started to use those techniques as well at Stanford to see if we could identify hearing loss in newborns. This is now called the brainstem evoked response technique, or automated brainstem response technique, and it's one of the standard ways in which infants are screened throughout the country soon after birth. The beauty of that technique is that you don't have to control for sleep state in quite the same way as you do for other techniques related to brain responses. And the responses are unique and stereotypical, so that no matter where we record them, that is what part of the country we're in, or to a large degree the kind of specific technique we use, they tend to look the same. And so
right.
We can compare results.
So there's some standardization.
Yes, exactly. But then along the 1980s, it was discovered by a physicist working in England that a healthy ear produces sound every time it responds to sound. And this sound is called an otoacoustic, which is ear acoustic, emission or output. And what was surprising for us to learn at the time was that the ear is an active biological amplifier. And most of the cells that are in your inner ear devoted to hearing are actually amplifying energy rather than doing listening for you. Mm-hmm. And if these cells are healthy, as they are in a typical newborn, then we can present a soft sound to the ear, and we will get what used to be called an echo back from the ear that lasts much, much longer than the incoming sound. And it has a tremendous amount of energy in it. If we see that response, called an otoacoustic emission, then we know that the ear is working normally from the outer ear into the part that mm-hmm. is encoding things, or the inner ear part. So otoacoustic emissions also has been used and have been embraced as a way to screen newborns for hearing loss. And in many facilities, you'll see emissions used as the first line of screen. And if an infant does not pass that particular screen, then they might follow up with the brainstem response test, which can be automated and done very simply, to help to confirm whether or not a problem is present.
And the otoacoustic emissions are much less invasive and easier to obtain.
Yes, although so, I think that the automated electric techniques have made things much easier on the electrical side of things as well, certainly much better than they were when we were starting so many years ago. And so I think if we look through all the hospitals that are doing this, we'd probably find about half and half in terms of the first line of screen. And the confirmation is usually done by the electrical technique. So,
but yeah. It's so interesting to me in terms of how quickly the field has progressed over the last 30 to 40 years. And it's interesting to me as I was studying for my doctorate, I don't remember. Actually, I think it relates to impedance audiometry, one of the tests that we do. And they were talking about it in an historical perspective. And the historical perspective was really 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And so just looking over your career, what wasn't available 40 years ago and what has now really become standard operating procedure, easier results to obtain has really has helped us in the diagnosis and treatment of hearing loss. And I know that you're very modest about it, but a lot of your research has been instrumental in that. So,
well, and your point about the time cycle on these is very well taken. David Kemp, who discovered the otoacoustic emissions, has studied actually the evoked potential techniques that we were just describing, the emission techniques, and the middle ear studies that you just referred to. And in every case, he traced the history from the first laboratory presentation about the potential usefulness of this to clinical implementation, and the cycle was almost precisely 25 years.
Pretty amazing.
It takes about a quarter of a century. And in my case, I've just been fortunate to be around for the startup on two or three of these things.
Yes,
and, I won't have a 75-year career, but 75 years of progress has been packed into a shorter career simply by happy accident.
Very, very true. So let's kind of take it then to the next level in terms of diagnosis. And I think that we've certainly talked about the benefit of the early diagnosis is being able to aid these children so that speech and language will not be as delayed as it has been in the past, being able to mainstream these children so that they can be in a regular school program.
Or certainly get them ready for the first grade
yeah.
at an age-appropriate time,
yeah.
and they may still need some assistance. And that of course, is one benefit of the early detection. One of the things that we've learned along the way is the most common cause of deafness in newborns who don't have other medical issues going on at the same time is what's called a recessive trait. Both parents carry a gene that when expressed or when it fails to express in the inner ear fails to thrive. And this produces profound deafness. And if there is profound deafness, a hearing aid is not likely to be of great assistance.
Right.
And so it opens the door to the other question the other development that has been so marvelous in the past 25 or 30 years, and that is cochlear implants. And the cochlear implants are now performed on infants as young as 12 months of age. And in those instances where infants are receiving them and everything else is working well, the speech of those infants at speech of those children at a later stage in time is indistinguishable mm-hmm. from the speech of individuals that hear normally.
And exactly, which has been such a wonderful benefit.
Yes, it's hard to appreciate that these are really deaf people
right.
receiving an artificial stimulus of some type. Our first cochlear implant patients, and I can use R in this case because I was part of that piece, could not understand a conversation face-to-face like we are having. And the signals were so crude that they couldn't even decipher digits. So if I gave you a list of digits, you know, one of those is a two-syllable word. Digit 7.
Right.
And our early patients couldn't distinguish between the word 7 and the word 4, for example. In addition, the electronics were built into a briefcase, there were actually wires running from the briefcase to a plug that emerged from the mastoid of the patients. When I first moved to Tucson, one of the Stanford patients was a Tucsonan, and so I work with him over here in Tucson as well, and you can imagine the excitement at the airport when he would show up to fly back to Stanford with his briefcase full of electronics
right,
and wires
right.
going into his head. this day, I think it'd be pretty difficult to get on board an
aircraft.
And in those days, actually, the pilot said, "Well, can I keep that with me in the cockpit?" So
just in case.
So it was really an exciting time. You know, a time of great discovery, and I think also how brave these patients were, adults who were deafened, who were willing to try these new things. With no idea whether or not we were going to help them or hurt them. And then things have come along in such a dramatic fashion that as we've just mentioned, infants as young as 12 months are now being implanted with great success.
And the surgery is being done as an outpatient surgery, which in itself is amazing.
Yeah, pretty remarkable.
So let's take a break to hear from our sponsors. We're talking with Dr. Ted Glatke.
You're listening to Live Local Weekend Talk on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice, and streaming on the web at kvoi.com.
Do you have difficulty hearing and understanding when people talk to you? Have you been fit with hearing aids but don't use them because they don't work? This is Dr. Janice Gash, Founding Director of Arizona Hearing Specialists. For 30 years, I've been hearing these questions and many more like them. I'd like to invite you to call now with your questions and concerns at 790-2040 or call Arizona Hearing Specialists to schedule your appointment for a hearing evaluation at 742-2845. That's 742-2845.
What if you could grant a dream for a child who has a lifelong illness? Well, you can certainly help. Join us for the first annual Birdies for Dreams golf tournament, cookout, and live auction, Friday, April 1st at Oro Valley Country Club in Oro Valley. Proceeds will benefit the Dream Factory of Arizona, a nonprofit organization that grants dreams for chronically and critically ill children ages 3 to 18. The golf scramble starts at 1 p.m. and the event fee is only $125. And if you don't play golf, you can join us for the cookout and live auction of fabulous items starting at 5:30 for just $35. It's sure to be a fun-filled day, and it's all for a great cause. So help us grant the dreams of some very special children and make their lives just a little brighter. Register now for the Birdies for Dreams Golf Tournament, cookout, and live auction. April 1st at Oro Valley Country Club. Call 906-8106. That's 906-8106. For more information, visit OroValleyCountryClub.com. Thank you for your support.
Ventana Automotive and Tire is a full-service mechanic shop that works on all makes and models. Owner Elton Kodoma has built up Ventana Automotive and Tire to 3 locations and hires only the best in the business. All mechanics are ASE certified. If you need service on your vehicle or a second opinion, visit the website at VentanaAuto.com to find a location nearest to you and also get some great money-saving coupons. That's VentanaAuto.com. Ventana Automotive and Tire. We're here when you need us.
Hey Tucson, Dr. Hancock here, and you know, in almost 30 years of practice, I've never seen ever more of an emphasis on health. Whether it's a national health care, socialized medicine, swine flu, seasonal flu, whatever it is. And I'll tell you, you got to keep up on this stuff. The good news is we got not one but two shows. We have Saturday afternoon from 5 to 6, Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9, and we are here to help you. Dr. Hancock here, thanks for being there and listening.
Dr. Janice is in now to answer your questions about hearing. It's Hearing Matters, only on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice. Call in now at 790-2040. That's 790-2040.
Welcome back to Hearing Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Janice Gash, and we're talking today with Dr. Ted Glatke. So, Ted, before the break, we were talking about cochlear implants. And how both the surgery and the implant and the results have changed so much over a very short period of time. Let's talk a little bit more about that and kind of where you see that leading to.
Well, the progress has indeed been remarkable. And if you think about where we were in the late 60s, early 70s, we assumed that by implanting a foreign object into living ear, that if the ear weren't destroyed before we put the object in, it would certainly be afterwards. And what's happened over this 30-year period is that the techniques have become so advanced that there are now, in experimental mode, even partial implants. And what I mean by this would be a device that is inserted into the inner ear only part of the way along its full 36-millimeter length. And it's the partial implant allows the person with the appropriate hearing configuration to use his or her normal hearing in part of the frequency range and use the implant for information in the other frequency range. For those of you that are musicians out there, the normal test range that we use for clinical work spans a piano keyboard or one octave off the right end of the piano keyboard. And what we're talking about here is giving people a sensation associated with those sounds that are at the right end of the piano keyboard or off the right end of the piano keyboard, 4 and 8,000 hertz and thereabouts. And to me, the amazing thing is that you can insert this device into the cochlea and not destroy the rest of it. That is, not destroy the part that is functioning normally. This is a very exciting development, and it speaks not only to the advances in technology, but to the creativity of the teams that are working on these kinds of issues around the world.
But also taking a look at realizing that people with hearing loss only in that 4,000 to 8,000 range or 3,000 to 8,000 range do experience significant difficulty in terms of understanding speech because of so much of the high frequency energy. And that's pretty exciting.
Yes, it
because I think for very long, you know, even from our perspective, there weren't even hearing aids that could reach to that range. And so we would say to our patients, come back when you have more hearing loss. But in fact, they were having enough difficulty on a day-to-day basis that they did need something. So from my perspective, from the high-frequency hearing loss, the advent of the high-frequency hearing loss, so many people that 5 years ago would not have been able to be helped are able to be helped. And so this is a great development.
And not only from the standpoint of cochlear implants, but also the standpoint of acoustic hearing aids as well.
Yeah.
And so the transducers or little miniature loudspeakers that become available can reach into this frequency range. And previously that was very difficult to accomplish, as you've pointed out.
Right.
And there are advances in the exotic end, if you will, the cochlear implant end, as well as the no less important, more traditional behind-the-ear style hearing aid that can be helpful to people.
Yeah. And I think we've talked a little bit about how the advent of cochlear implants has affected the lives of some of these infants and children just in terms of normal speech and language, being able to be in school, not being differentiated because you can't really tell the difference between whether they're hearing or not. Very interesting. I did a hearing at hearing screening at one of the schools this week, and one of the girls came in and she said, "Well, I don't have to do this test." And she said, "'Cause I have she picked up her hair on both sides because I have cochlear implants on both ears." And if she hadn't told me just by listening to her speech, I wouldn't have even thought that she had hearing loss. And I neglected to ask her how old she was when she was implanted, but I'm sure she was quite young and is able to function perfectly well in that regular school environment. So it was very exciting, very exciting. I think just seeing the implants that are being done on children today is just miraculous to watch.
It certainly opens up opportunities for them that they would not otherwise be able to address. And and the corollary to that is your experience with the young girl that you just described. This is nothing that's embarrassing for them. It's something
exactly.
that they're they have some pride in. And if you see adults walking around with implants in Tucson, chances are the implant will have a decal on it that makes it look like an American flag
right.
or an Arizona
right.
flag
right.
or some other
right.
thing that's important to the person who's using it.
Absolutely.
And very gratifying to reflect on that whole history.
Yeah, well, you know, people walk around with their Bluetooth, bigger is better, and
exactly.
All the different colors, and people are becoming more aware of it. And I think just raising the awareness of all the wonderful things that can be done to help people with hearing loss is changing.
Well, one of the areas that has emerged from the basic science on this is kind of a tangent to cochlear implants, but I'd like to bring it up. When we got interested in the energy that was being produced by the ear and started studying, and I'm using we collectively as the science field, not me, individuals also became interested in protective mechanisms for the inner ear. And one thing we know now is that if you're a chicken and you get exposed to loud sound and lose all of your inner ear hair cells, you can grow a whole new set in 30 days.
Really?
And you not only grow them, but they get wired up and seem to be responding just the way the set that was destroyed respond. Experimentally, this you could cause a problem for a bird by introducing medication, say, that in excess in a human would cause profound hearing loss. And 30 days after the drug has been introduced and the receptor cells have been destroyed, a whole new set show up. And again, they get wired up and they seem to be doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. So it sort of raises a couple of questions. Why does the chicken have to hear better than we do?
Right. That's not fair.
I don't have an answer for that one. But isn't it exciting to think about what might be possible in terms of biological engineering of some type, genetics or what, to get these things turned on in the right way in mammals? And there is a tremendous amount of work being done around the world in that area now. We know that these receptor cells can be generated. We don't in mammals like us. We just don't know if they can be taught to do the right things the way they seem to do in birds. But there are birds that learn new songs every year and get rewired for all sorts of communication purposes. And
it's
interesting. You know, who would have thought that
yes.
you would invite a chicken into your lab to learn something about human hearing?
But, very interesting. Well, that is very exciting. Very exciting. Let's change the tactic a little bit. A lot of our older patients, whether they have hearing loss or not, also have been experiencing balance problems. And I know that that's something that you've been very involved in over the years and more recently. Let's talk a little bit about assessing balance problems and treating balance issues.
Well, yes, I'm happy to do that. A very gratifying part of what I've been able to do, especially as I'm in a retired mode, so to speak, is is work with age-matched peers who are having some of the difficulties that you've just referred to. The sad fact is that about one-third of adults over the age of 65 are likely to fall sometime in the year. And an even sadder fact is that about one-fifth of that group will fall a second time after they've recovered from the first fall. And this leads into what's sometimes called a downward spiral, in which people become
right.
less mobile. They may fracture a hip or a leg or some other part of their body that will keep them confined to a bed or under much more restricted conditions than would be helpful for them. So it's not, I wouldn't use the word epidemic, but we're seeing more and more of this because we're living longer.
Exactly.
And more of us are at increased risk for falls. Individuals with balance problems can be assessed in a number of ways. You need three things in order to know which way is up. You need good vision, You need a good body sense. That is, you need to know that your feet are on the ground and where they're positioned. And you need this inner ear sense that we call the vestibular sense. And this is a silent sense that normally we ignore until something goes wrong. And then if we become car sick or motion sick or have trouble at the edge of the Grand Canyon,
right,
peering over the edge, it's because of some conflict that we're having, often involving that particular system. And so we're now capable, through a number of techniques, of evaluating these systems one by one and learning how a patient is able to, who's having trouble with balance, is able to use all three of those sensory systems. So we evaluate their stability first by allowing them to play with a full deck of cards, that is everything that they have available, and then we take away their vision by having them close their eyes and see how they do. And then we fib to their vision, which is kind of like taking you to the edge of the Grand Canyon and making you look over the edge and see how you do.
That, I wouldn't enjoy that, no.
And then in another situation, we make a platform unstable, and I describe it, sort of depends on their generation, but if there's a certain generation, I ask them if they ever owned a waterbed. And if they do, I say, did you ever try to stand up on it? And our loose platform is kind of like that. But otherwise, I tell them it's like standing up on a canoe. And then finally, we make them stand up in the canoe with their eyes closed. And so at that point, they have to rely on this inner ear system.
Right.
And by sorting our way through their successes and challenges with those modalities, we can begin to get an idea of what needs to be addressed in terms of issues. We can also test the inner ear balance mechanism itself in isolation. And most people don't realize that their inner ear balance mechanism controls their eye motion, but it does in most normal circumstances. And what I'm referring to is what enables you to drive a car and look from side to side and still be able to maintain your orientation.
Right.
Or to go to the grocery store and scan the shelves and be able to see what's on the shelves and not become completely disoriented. And what is happening there is there's a reflex between your inner ear and your eyes, and your eyes adjust for the head motion that you choose to introduce. So we study eye motion in order to figure out if the inner ear is working. And then we stimulate the inner ear, specifically one side at a time, by gently changing the temperature of the ear. And the way I describe this to patients is that we have canals like carpenter levels in each inner ear, and I get the canals aimed at the ceiling, and I warm them up. And so the fluid in the carpenter level moves toward the top when
right.
I warm it up, and that allows me to evaluate whether or not the ear is working. And if we identify a problem with one side or both sides, if we identify problems with any of the other sensory systems, then with appropriate referral and with medical management, individuals can often be treated very successfully and be restored to a level of function that they didn't think that they could ever get back to.
Let's just take a break, and then I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the treatment options for patients with balance issues.
Start your morning in Southern Arizona with Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekdays 4 to 6 on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice.
Do you have ringing in your ears? This is Dr. Janice Gash, founding director of Arizona Hearing Specialists. If you have ringing in your ears, you might have tinnitus. Tinnitus is a medical condition characterized by persistent ringing in one or both ears, which can only be heard by the affected individual. It has also been described as whistling, hissing, buzzing, or pulsing in the ear. These sounds may come and go. However, many sufferers experience symptoms 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The effects range from slight annoyance to severe disruption of everyday life. The American Tinnitus Association estimates that over 50 million Americans suffer from tinnitus. Oftentimes, tinnitus is associated with hearing loss, and if you have this condition, we may be able to help. Call Arizona Hearing Specialists for your hearing evaluation at 742-2845. That's 742-2845.
The Tucson Jazz Society and Fox Tucson Theater present and Jack Furrier Tire and Auto Care invite you to experience great jazz in a new way this spring with new venues and new nights. Starring Tucson favorite and world-renowned jazz great Diane Shore with the Jeff Daniel Group, Friday, April 8th, 8 p.m. at the Fox Tucson Theater. Get your reserved seat tickets now at TucsonJazz.org.
A child is taken. But there is hope through the Arizona Amber Alert. An Amber Alert provides the public with information that could lead to the safe recovery of a child. When a child is missing, everyone plays an important role. To learn more about the details of a specific Amber Alert, dial 511. Together, we can all help save a child.
10 years in the making by the artisans of the Pharaonic Village in Egypt in association with the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Now, in Tucson, for a special limited engagement, Rialto Arts and Antiquities presents Tutankhamun, Wonderful Things from the Pharaoh's Tomb. Today through April 30th, journey back in time and discover more than 130 of the most spectacular golden replicas of original artifacts placed in King Tut's tomb more than 3,000 years ago. Explore the mystery of the life and death of Egypt's youngest pharaoh and learn the secrets of his post-mortem journey into the afterlife. This once-in-a-lifetime exhibit is here for a short time, yet it is an experience the entire family will cherish for years to come. The King Tut exhibit is located downtown Tucson at 300 East Congress Street inside the Rialto Arts and Antiquities Museum. Listeners to KVOI get special discount pricing as a gift for supporting the arts and our station. Just go to KingTutTucson.com or call 1-888-71-TICKETS to learn more. Use promotion code KVOI.
Dr. Janice is in now to answer your questions about hearing. It's Hearing Matters, only on AM 1030 KVOI, the voice. Call in now at 790-2040. That's 790-2040.
Welcome back to Hearing Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Janice Gash, and we're talking today with Dr. Ted Glatke. Ted, we were talking a little bit about balance problems, And maybe we can talk real briefly about some of the treatment options, and then I'd love to talk a little bit about your work and my work at St. Andrew's Children's Clinic in Nogales.
Sure. Regarding the patients with balance issues, of course, I'm speaking as an audiologist, and we do not offer a medical diagnosis at the Balance Center, but we can identify the system that has been affected.
Right.
And so I wouldn't want any of my comments to be construed as offering medical advice to anyone. Sometimes, though, the outcome of the evaluation will prompt us to refer the patient to the physician with the idea that perhaps additional diagnostic work might need to be done to help to uncover the medical issue. Sometimes, for example, we find that patients are taking many, many, many prescription medications. And what we do know statistically is that if you take more than five prescriptions, you may be at some risk for increased difficulty. And so another piece of advice is often to consult with their physician and pharmacist and see whether or not their medical prescription list can be simplified
yes,
in some way
very,
or to
very.
Address issues that that might be contributing to a lack of stability. But when medical issues are ruled out, then we work with physical therapists who can design a course of basically exercises that will challenge an individual to use their weakest link, if you will. So if they're having trouble because of inner ear issues and they don't have a good reflex response when they're moving their head, then they may be given exercises that will help them enhance that and learn to rewire themselves, if you will. If there are issues related to weakness in limbs or extremities, then there may be exercises that will be assigned to help individuals with those particular kinds of problems. A typical combination, for example, all too frequent combination, I should say, not typical, at the Balance Center would be a patient who has advanced diabetes and therefore has limited sensation in their feet and legs, in addition to having some other issues. And so the intervention there may focus on helping them to strengthen their what they
awareness.
Need to strengthen
yeah.
and awareness, and also making them safer around their home. The interventions maybe are as complicated as the folks
right.
that come to
exactly.
see us, and there's no one prescriptive thing that we could say for everyone. But many individuals have many factors that are affecting their ability to maintain their equilibrium, and what we try to do is address as many of those as we can within within the Balanced Clinic environment.
And just to be aware that the Balanced Clinic is part of the Neurological Institute at Carondelet at St. Joseph's Hospital. And just as we talk with our patients about, you can't do anything about your hearing loss if you haven't had an evaluation to diagnose it, the diagnosis is an extremely important first step to take.
Exactly.
So let's talk about something that's very close to my heart and has become close to your heart, too, the St. Andrew's Children's Clinic in Nogales. I was trying to remember how many years ago you approached me, again, one of your previous retirements, and you said, well, I'm going to have some time, and I'd really like to get involved in the clinic.
For the life of me, I can't remember that either.
I know. A few years ago.
Yeah, I remember riding down to Clinica with you. And for those that don't know about St. Andrew's, this clinic has been in operation for about 40 years. Janice was one of the founding contributors. There are approximately 200 volunteers who function at the clinic the first Thursday of every month except July. And the purpose is to provide essential treatments for medically indigent children from Mexico. And so it's been a very rewarding experience. And each month we see about 8 or 10 patients with hearing loss, new patients with hearing loss. And Janice, I believe you've got about 200 children under your care who have hearing aids and who come back to you for repeated support.
At least. And we see probably about 15 to 20.
Per month, yeah.
And it's just, it's been a great, having you down there, you know, we used to do all the evaluations and the fitting and the follow-up. And when you came on, you worked with Midtown Sertoma Club to help us secure the trailer. And the trailer has two sound booths in it. And being able to separate out the diagnostics from the actual fitting and follow-up has been a tremendous improvement and really helped us streamline what we're doing in terms of helping these children.
And not only streamline, but we were incapable of testing a child who had normal hearing in the old environment, because in one corner someone would be having earwax removed and would be very unhappy. And just in the next room they would be working on orthotic devices and hammering and sawing away. And so we expressed a need to move out of the joint room. And Father Ed, who used to be the pastor at St. Andrew's and the clinic director, provided his RV for the first year or so, and we'd all bundle into the RV and try to do it. So Midtown Sertoma was very helpful in helping us set up the diagnostic suites.
So talk a little bit. We only have about 2 minutes left because you've kind of taken the Clinica program to another level, working with underserved adults in Nogales. And talk to us a little bit about that and some of the solar-powered hearing aids that you're also working on also.
Well, there's a huge gap between the number of hearing aids produced in the world and the number of people that need them. There are 9 million produced in a year. There are 300 million people that need hearing aids. And the vast majority of those people are in developing countries. So I've been fortunate enough to become engaged with a group that is trying to develop affordable hearing aids. And not only the hearing aids, but the most expensive part of the hearing aid after purchase are the batteries. In fact, I think statistics provided at NIH recently in the past year have suggested that the largest expense after your home and your car is your hearing aid as a senior adult. So we're trying to make these more affordable for individuals. And we're doing so, the group is doing so in part by building a solar charger for rechargeable hearing aid batteries, as well as engaging nonprofits to build low-cost hearing aids for distribution to medically indigent individuals. And the group that I'm working with is called Solar Ear. It's in Brazil. That's one word, S-O-L-A-R-E-A-R. And I just happened to meet the founder of that at an airport in Brazil about 6 years ago, and I thought, gee, this would be a great way to spend some time.
Uh-huh.
And it's turning into one of the most rewarding pieces, which will include outreach clinics in Mexico that will respond not only to children but to medically indigent adults as well, to provide them with amplification and the care that they need.
It's a great project. And again, I'm sure when we talk in another very short time, I don't think it's going to take 25 years for this to come to fruition. We'll see a program that will really help us serve the underserved adults and children in Mexico and other third world countries. We've covered a lot. I'm exhausted just thinking about your career and all the fabulous discoveries that you've been a part of. I really want to tell you how much I appreciate you being on the show. And in a way, I kind of look forward to going into retirement again, because it means you'll be on the cusp of something new that will strike your fancy. So thank you so much for being with us today, Ted. And I hope our listeners enjoyed the show and will join us next Sunday at 2 p.m. for Hearing Matters. So thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for including me.
You've been listening to Hearing Matters with Dr. Janice Gash. Join us again next Sunday at 2 p.m. on AM 1030 KVOI The Voice. And to make an appointment at Arizona Hearing Specialist, call 742-2845. Hearing Matters, helping you hear your best.